Welcome to Stronger Together, a powerful podcast series hosted by Impact Community Services. I'm Tanya O'Shea, Managing Director of Impact, and I have the pleasure of frontlining this little passion project of ours. In the podcast, we dig into some of the meaty social problems that people are facing within our communities, and we chat with guests willing to tackle the hard conversations. We want you to be kept informed and updated on the latest information, yet are also aware that some of the topics address sensitive issues that could be triggering or distressing for some listeners. If you find any of the content challenging, we encourage you to pause the episode and seek immediate support. Information on where to seek help will be provided at the end of each episode and also on Impact's website, impact.org.au. Please prioritise your well-being while listening. Before we begin, we would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we live, work and meet. We pay our respects to the elders past, present and future, for they hold the memories, traditions, the culture, hopes and values not only of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but of all Australians. Now, let's delve into the important conversations awaiting us in today's episode. Hello, my name's Tanya O'Shea and welcome to this episode of the Stronger Together podcast. Today we're talking all about loneliness and social isolation, which actually is quite surprising to me that almost one in three Australians are feeling lonely today. I reflect on that because of the amount of information that's available, people talking about followers and friends that they have on social media. And interestingly, it is social media that is causing the greatest amount of loneliness in people's lives. So that's what the research is telling us. Now, when I'm referring to loneliness, what that is looking at is that unpleasant or distressing feeling that people are experiencing as a result of a lack of connection with other people. We know as human beings, we are social beings. We like to be or feel connected with others. Some of us look to do that on social media, and it doesn't have that same level of impact for us that we experience when we're actually dealing with people face to face. And I think as humans, that's where we actually get the most fulfillment, when we're talking to people, when we're connecting with people, when we're sharing with other people. Now, as I said right at the get-go with this episode, one in three Australians are experiencing loneliness at the moment. When I think about my own experience, I guess, throughout life, I have had moments of loneliness. I've felt disconnected from other people. I've had fights with family and friends, but I have been fortunate enough to be able to find a way to resolve them or find a different outlet or path that I could actually start to reconnect within community, part of that through my work, but part of that through my personal life as well. I was having a conversation with a lady called Sharon last week, and Sharon made a really good observation. Sharon is an Aboriginal woman, not from the local area, but has strong roots within the local area. And she said, "You and I have come from very different worlds. You have been on a path where you've been educated, you've been to school, you've probably been to uni," and she was right about that observation as well. "You've got a family, you've got a house." She said, "For me, that experience has been very, very different. And it felt like a bit of a parallel universe happening, a bit of a sliding doors moment right at that time for me." And I thought, you know what, we've got to explore this further. There's a real story in here. And Sharon has been wonderful enough to join me here today. So thank you, Sharon, for coming in and sharing your story with us.
That's fine, Tanya.
So lovely. It was really lovely to meet you last week and talk through some of your story. And you've talked and shared with me some of the social isolation and the loneliness that you felt in your life. Now, we touched on my experience. For you, your mother, when you were born, your mother handed you over to your grandparents. Your grandparents, loving grandparents, your mother then removed you from your grandparents. You went into a violent, isolated environment where you were then further removed from welfare and totally disconnected from your family. You then went from family to family. Education wasn't the focus for you, so education was looked very different. And then you found yourself in later years in a relationship where you again experienced significant isolation, not able to get your driver's license.
Not just one relationship, a number of relationships, because you take what you can get. Mm-hmm. Again, it's part of that isolation because you no longer have, you don't have your own identity. You don't know who you are. Mm. So you will stay, you will have a series of domestic violence relationships. They're always the same. You know, the need to form a partnership, a bond, and have a family with somebody,
yes,
is inherent in you. Mm. So you just roll on to the next one. But because that's what you're used to, you don't like the domestic violence. But that's all you think that you're entitled to. That's all you... That's your life.
No. And those learnings for you started in childhood. So tell us about that turning point for you when things really started to change.
For the worse.
For the worst.
I was 9 years old and my biological mother had married a white man that was not liked by my grandparents or me. And they had been away on their honeymoon, whatever. And she showed up at the house one day, my grandparents' house, and said, I've come to get Sharon. You're coming to live with me. And I said no, and my grandmother said no. And then there was a physical fight where my biological mother had hold of one part of me and my grandmother had hold of the other. On the stairs, she's trying to drag me down. The other one was trying to drag me back up. And in the end, my grandmother let go. And I was taken, mother dragged me down to the car where her new husband was waiting outside the fence, threw me in there and was looking out the back window. That's when I went to live with the mother and her new husband and the abuse started there.
So prior to, age nine, it sounds like you have that really vivid memory of being removed.
Oh, yeah.
What was it like prior to that with your grandparents?
It was what I would assume is normal. I went to Sunday school because my grandmother was a church organist, mm-hmm. so he had to go. I was a member of the GFS, which was the Girls Friendly Society to do with the church. I was in the swim club. I was a Highland dancer. I had medals for my dancing mm-hmm. and certificates. I played the organ. I had friends. I had cousins. Cousins that today, if I fell over them in the street, I wouldn't know who they were.
Wow.
So not just them, all their children below them. So there's big families mm-hmm. there that I've never met. I was good at school. My grandmother had the early primary school reports, and they were all A's. And by the time 2 years taken away, I was getting F's. I was failing. But life was what I would call was normal. And, you know, you ask your children, what do you want to be when you grow up? Mm. They were always asking me and I would say things like a vet or, and they were all behind, you know, they would have sent me to uni.
Mm-hmm.
There wouldn't have been a problem. My grandmother's family were settlers
mm-hmm.
of that small town. They were one of the first families there.
Yeah, wow.
But my grandfather came from England. He came over in 28, but they were well known in the town, well established in the town there.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of little country towns are divided, there'll be a divide, an invisible divide.
Mm.
And this one was the railway line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, don't mix with those over the line.
Mm-hmm.
Or, she lives over the line, don't go there.
Mm-hmm.
So my grandparents were on this side of the line.
But you were still part of a community. You were
always,
still connected with family.
Always.
You felt like you had friends.
I can remember Christmases.
Yeah.
I can remember my grandmother for weeks beforehand cooking and hanging up boiled puddings under the house.
Yeah.
In cheesecloths and always cooking and the families, the cousins and that coming in Christmas Day, the big tables, the big everything. Nana in her apron. And, I can only remember one Christmas after that. After I got taken away, I only remember one Christmas, and that was at a foster, what they called a trial placement, mm-hmm. Where I was sent to work in a business that they owned and lived at.
Mm-hmm.
And so come Christmas Day for them, I was doing all the cooking and the I was, 14 going on 15.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to set all the table out. And I only remember because it was a big job.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, why am I, I'm not part of this. It's not Christmas for me. Why am I doing this? But I do not remember a single Christmas with my mother or anything. So I don't know whether I blocked those out or we didn't have them.
Mm.
But, yeah, there was plenty of cousins. There was... Wow. It was just what I would – I don't like the word normal, but
mm-hmm. – It felt,
it
yeah.
It was normal. Almost, the only – like I didn't even realise until I went to grade one that my grandfather was actually my grandfather. I wasn't told to call him Dad. I called him Pop. So I was conscious that he wasn't my actual father, but it wasn't until one day in grade one when the teacher asked us to draw pictures of what our fathers did for work. So I drew a picture of my grandparents' house with my grandfather up there and his big belt and a rope leading to me
mm-hmm.
on
mm-hmm.
the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, he does this roofing. And one of the kids said, that's not your father, that's your grandfather.
Mm.
And it wasn't until that point in time that something sort of shifted a little bit in my brain that's not normal. Everyone else says that was dad they were living with.
Mm.
This is my grandfather. But it didn't change anything.
Mm.
They were still like mum and dad. Mm. But that was like the only thing with them that sort of went wrong. I was just, I was always his granddaughter. I went everywhere with him.
Mm.
We went to the dog shows. We went to the chook shows. We went everywhere with Nana.
Mm. Part of that community.
Oh, yeah.
And then at the age of 9, you were removed. So from
taken to mum, another
your
town.
Biological mother removed you, took you to another town, far away from where you were, and then into an abusive household.
Yeah. Oh, the house itself was shocking. Old place. I was used to my grandmother. Maybe I was a bit spoilt by grandmother, but she used to tuck me in at night. I always had clean sheets and things like that. There was no clean sheets over there. There was just... The house was cold. It was one of those houses that had been patched up over time.
Mm.
Old furniture. The bloke she married had 2 children older than me, a woman, a male and a female. And they had been raised by their grandmother as well, but they at least had each other.
Mm.
And I was tossed into this situation with 2 strangers and told, this is your new sister and your new brother. And this is your new father, and I understand he's not my father. They were different. They stopped me swimming. They stopped me dancing. There was nothing after that.
So there was no. So for you, I think one of the big things is here. We can all live in. We don't have to live in a palace, right? We can live with a roof over our head, in conditions, I guess, that some of us might go, well, actually, that's not as good as this, but. But if it's a really happy, connected, you feel like you're part of something and you can still participate in community, we can all get on with life, can't we?
Well, that's what I was saying about the house was only so to show, try to show that it went from one extreme to the other.
Yes.
And I'm 9. I'm working with a 9-year-old brain. I can look back now as an adult and see what I should have done or could have done, but I was 9 at the time and nobody was giving me any answers. Why did I have to leave my grandparents' house? I was also forced to change my name to fit in with her new husband.
Mm-hmm.
So they took even my name away from me.
Which is part of our identity, isn't it?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And stopped everything. So all my old friends were back in the other town.
Yes.
Because the man my mother married, I was not liked by the grandparents who were the top of the family here. That meant my auntie, my uncle, all of those there. they wouldn't have anything to do with him. So she wouldn't allow me to have anything to do with the cousins either. So not only were all my friends in another town, my cousins were in another town. It was like a complete different life. And from the time I was 9, I basically had to fend for myself. She went to work and he went to work. The two older ones, and they went to high school, and I was just there. I had to make my own lunch if I could.
Re-engaged with school? Like, were you enrolled in school at that stage?
I think it was grade 4 or grade 5.
Mm-hmm.
I did see primary school out. I had a few instances there for fighting at school, which I didn't used to do, but I was angry. Because as time went on, my mother's husband decided I was eating too much of his food. So he put padlocks on fridges and food cupboards. So I had nothing to eat. And this island girl, Donna, she used to bring me an extra Vegemite sandwich because she knew I was hungry. So she actually got me through with these Vegemite sandwiches in grade 6, I think.
Wow.
And I have met up with her since. But I was failing. I started to fail at school because I didn't have clean uniforms. I was tired. Sometimes if I went out, sometimes like when I come home after school, like they didn't finish work until late. So if one of those other two children weren't home, I couldn't get in the house.
Oh, you were locked out of the house as well.
I was locked out for years coming over and over, and locked out overnight sometimes.
Oh, goodness.
So I couldn't do, I'd be in trouble with the school for no homework. Well, where was I supposed to do my homework?
Mm.
I got in trouble with the uniforms were all wrinkly and that. I couldn't do it. I didn't know how to iron them because I had to wash them myself if I wanted to clean them because she was just not there. She was there for her husband and his children and I was at the bottom of the pecking order.
Mm.
Ironically, they didn't last very long there either, I think. The boy was gone 12 months later and the girl not long after that, mightn't even have been 12 months. But they went to the mother. Their mother was still alive and my father was still alive as well, but my mother wasn't letting on where he was or anything.
You didn't have that connection.
Yeah.
So there was abuse in that relationship and welfare stepped in.
Yes, yeah.
And removed you from that family, is that correct?
No, they did what they called voluntary. I don't know on whose side was voluntary, but voluntary supervision for a period of time. A small country town, so it didn't have your own children's services. They used to come once a week from a larger town. She'd come down and talk to you and then talk to them and then talk to the school and tell you what you should be doing. My mother and her husband always had the answers like, I remember the social worker early days asking, where did I get all the bruises from? Because there was bruises on my face, my neck, let alone one you couldn't see. And they said, oh, it's the bruising. Oh, she gets them from fights at school with other children. Those bruises weren't from the other children. And she has reported a few times on my file, the social worker, that it was obvious I'd been hit by Mr. his name. All around the face, I have warned the local police again. But the local police, they believed the parents, so you were allowed to kick the child up the bum if they were doing wrong.
Thankfully, things have changed and come a long way since then.
So that loneliness and isolation was there. That's when it cracked in at 9 because I had to fend for myself and there was nobody there. I did run away a couple of times and ran to my grandparents' place and the police would come and get you.
And take you straight back to
They take me back to the parents because at that point there was no court orders out.
Okay.
At that point. I had never wet the bed at my grandparents' place that I can ever remember.
Mm.
I started wetting the bed at this new place would have been 12 months in. So they took me to a child psychologist who helped me make a chart with gold stars on it for every night you didn't wet the bed. But it didn't work because it was just the fear and the way I was living. His answer to wetting the bed was to put another padlock on the linen cupboard, so you couldn't change the sheets or anything, see. So it was starting to take like physical and mental. So by the time I was 12 or 13, I didn't care, you know, like, because if I tried to do the right thing, I would be punished some way. So you think to yourself, aha, next time in that situation, don't do it that way, do it another way. You do it the other way and you get in trouble anyway, because he would change the rules and not tell you. So I didn't care. If I didn't want to go to school, I never went to school.
They're big decisions to make it at the age of 9, 10, aren't they?
Yeah, if I didn't want to come home, I wouldn't come home.
And no one really, you know, worrying or keeping an eye on where you're at.
So eventually the police just decided to take me to court and charge me with being uncontrollable.
And then what happened?
That made me a state ward until I was 18, not foster care, a state ward all up. And I was taken to an institution down in Brisbane, an institution which treated us as some sort of psychiatric problems. It was staffed by psychiatrists and psychologists and therapists. And they, what was their diagnosis? I was antisocial. I had an antisocial personality. So their regime was treat that with drugs. And behaviour modification. And so it talks heavily in my files because they kept like a ledger. At the end of the day, the nurses would write down things they'd observed you'd done during the day. And it, quite often it says, doesn't mix well with peers. Well, they'd send me from there out to what they call trial placements. So you'd go to these different places, Mundubbera, Julia Creek, all these outback places to do jobs that, you know, were an adult's job for starters. Julia Creek was a station. There was no other females on board. I ended up running away.
How old were you then?
I was 14 then.
So 14, no other females around.
They sent me out there as cook and fencer with the men. And the property's only 19 miles out of Julia Creek. Still there today. But I wasn't staying there with all those men out there. None of them were, you know, today you have approved foster parents, it's police checks, and that didn't happen back then. People wanted workers and that, they'd just contact children's services and get them. So wherever you went, you knew you weren't staying, you knew it wasn't permanent. Whether you liked it or not, it didn't matter. Could move you on at any given, because these different ones wouldn't want me and I'd go back there. And then they sent me back. They had some strange epiphany in them, I don't know where, that I should go home to my mother, not my grandmother, but my biological mother. I think it was a shift in the thinking of at that time of, you know, where families should be.
Reconnecting with family, yeah.
So they tried that one. That lasted 24 hours. I was just going on 15, I think 14 and a half or 15. I was sent back to the biological mother and her husband's house. The social worker was coming down the next day. She was first supposed to meet me at the aeroplane, but she didn't, and she's to come the next day. I only vaguely remember her arriving before I fell off the chair unconscious because I'd taken an overdose. I was about 14 and a half.
And you were that desperate to get out of that environment that you felt like that was your only option.
I didn't want to be back there. And like when you go into care, you don't think about, you don't know about suicide. You know, you learn all this in care. I was in a dormitory with another young girl. She was 10. She tried to hang herself in front of me one night. She was 10 years old. Now, a 10-year-old shouldn't even know what that is. It didn't work. She only had a bath towel, but that's not the point. She was deadly serious. She was killing herself that night. So it gets very bad with children. And so they sent me home to there. I had a series of overdoses, cut wrists and other things. Then the violence just started. It started from almost the word go back there. So I just ran away. I went to a big city. I was I think I spent my 16th birthday on the streets. We lived in a big squat. We owned nothing. There was a group of us, and you own nothing. So even that is a form of isolation. Sometimes you didn't even own the clothes that you had on because you'd pinched off somebody's clothesline the night before, you know. And, okay, we might have all been criminals, but we had to survive.
Was there a sense of connection within
the
that
others,
community?
Yes, there was, but you also knew in the back of your head you couldn't trust them because they were looking after, their priority was number one too. So if you had stooked some food or something for later and they saw you do it, they would take it.
Right.
You know, there was no real loyalty there to each other.
No one had each other's back.
Not wholly.
You had to look after yourself.
I had a couple of friends that we did for a while until we had a fight about something and never spoke again. So there was nights when you'd be sitting there and I used to think back, oh, how nice it would have been to be back at my grandma's house and the clean sheets and you could almost feel, and I'd sort of go off to sleep on the floor there or if we had a dirty old mattress or whatever. And we were actually still in the care of Children's Services. And,
So Sharon moved around during, so childhood, removed from family, experienced violence, isolated, you had basic essential needs removed, like access to shelter, access to food, access to clean linen and laundry and being able to wash your clothes. You were removed access to family, to friends, to connection, to community. Let's fast forward to adulthood and what you then took in. So all that while you're embedding and learning these skills around how to survive. But also relationships with other people. So what did you take forward into your relationships?
Basically that there's only one person you can rely on and that's yourself. And sometimes even then when you get to questioning yourself, then you start to lose it. You know, you have to make a decision and stick by it. But we knew that you learn there are nice people there, but you can't trust them. You couldn't let them in. If you let them in, they will find a way to hurt you. So the more some of those people, and there's only a few, older adults, but the more they tried to actually do for you, I don't know why they were doing it, but the more they tried to do for you, the more you would sort of rally against it a bit because you were testing them out. You're trying to push them away because you did like the attention, you did want their help and you needed their help, but you just didn't. You always thought it would come at some sort of cost. You learned that relationships came at a cost, a bad cost, always, regardless. I know, you know, there's a cost to everything, but there would always be something bad happen. So you learn not to trust 100%.
So it's almost like you become programmed and you start to isolate yourself from relationships quite deliberately so that you don't have the pain of going through when people let you down.
And it's not that you want to. You're actually conscious of what you're doing.
It's a very clear decision. But and I can hear that as you're talking through it. It's a clear decision that you make to protect yourself.
Because over time it gets to you. You can't. You know, because there was nowhere to go. If you were upset, this is no one to talk to. You know, we had phone lines like Lifeline and that, but we didn't have a telephone. There was no mobile phones and things like that. And a lot of times those sort of centres didn't cater to kids. They would ring the police if we were underage. So you couldn't even go to those sort of authorities that were supposed to help. To get help from them, you'd have to put yourself back in the system. And you didn't want that. So it just, and for everything that went wrong as you grew up, it just reinforced that bit of isolation. You're always offside with somebody. You're wanting to be friends with them and you'll be friends, but you'll never be right in
always
depths.
Guarded, always got the heckles up,
always
looking.
And always questioning, why are you talking to me? Why? What is it? Why do you want to be my friend?
What do you want from me?
Yes, the one, you know. And that went into your intimate relationships, the the men you learned early on. My grandparents weren't violent. The other violence I learned when I was taken from them and then into the system, that became the norm. And you learn to live with that violence. Again, you question it. You knew in the back of your brain it wasn't supposed to be like that. But it was also a bit of your safety zone. It was something you knew. So you expected the old man.
It was comfortable.
To belt you.
It was comfortable. Yeah. It was a comfortable space because you were so used to it.
For every time you woke up with a black eye or a split lip, you'd say, oh, I'm never going back there. But you did because you had nowhere else to go.
Mm.
We had women's shelters, but they did not have the things like they have today to house you, to move you from town to town, to help you. They were just like a stopgap measure. Mm. And I couldn't go back to my own family, to my grandparents. I tried that. And the police would always come and get me because I was in care till I was 18.
Mm.
I had a child. I was pregnant when I was 14. Then when I got pregnant again, because they don't bother about giving you any birth control or telling you. I was pregnant again at 15. I had a son. They tried to take him. I had him with me for 2 years. They couldn't fault it. They said, and my father, other than Sharon's life being chaotic, she does love her baby. He's clean. He's looked after. And then when he was 2 years old, they managed to take him again. And bang, he's back in the system. They took him. They gave him to my biological mother. He got bashed. He got flogged. He got the same I got. And then he went into care. 2 years in court. I got him returned to me, but the damage was done to him. He was 12 years old and the damage was done. And from then on, he just roamed around the place. We never knew where he was. Wouldn't stay at school. I had a phone call from the police, from the Adelaide police. He was dead in the park over there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Didn't even know he was in Adelaide. He was living as a homeless person in Rose Park over there because it was that same system. That isolated him as well. It's just the way that was.
Mm. So that trauma that you've obviously taken through your life, that fear that you walk around with around relationships, that unwillingness to connect with others and, you want to isolate to keep yourself protected. When you were in intimate relationships as an adult, so you said, I've been living with a number of men, those were also relationships where you were isolated. So you have only got your driver's license in the last five years.
Yeah.
Because that was about you then not having independence, able to. So, Sharon, do you mind me asking how old you are?
58, I think.
So
nearly
so,
60, yeah.
Yeah. So 5 years ago was the first opportunity that you had to get your driver's license.
Basically, we could always drive, always did. Didn't get caught a few times and charged with unlicensed driving. But it was like I didn't think I had any choice there either, because your fear of the police is pretty big too.
But that was built from a very young age, wasn't it? Mm.
Yeah, that was all part of his, and we lived on properties out of town, which I didn't mind, but that was all part of that keeping you away from everywhere else all the time. He had the only vehicle and the only license, and he used to keep the keys on a clip on his belt all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you went inside, he'd take that off, put it with his wallet, put it in his drawer. Yeah, even when they had the old bank books, he used to lock his bank book. Same. I never knew how much money.
So did you have access to money?
Yes, I used to get money.
Mm.
There was a short period in time, though, once when we had no money, Centrelink wouldn't give me any money. They said he earned too much money, so I couldn't have any money for the kids. And that was like, pretty thing. And I said, I did argue with Centrelink. They said, you've got to get it off him. You'd have Tyne Endowment or you'd have FT. They kept changing the names, Children's Money. And I did work a few times. I did work in the Territory and that. So I had my own little bit of money, but mostly it went on the rent and the kids. Yeah, I just one day here 5 years ago, The washing machine broke down again, and I was just, it was like the straw that broke the camel's back. And I walked out to where he was sitting there having his coffee, and I said, get out. And he just looked at me and I said, well, I'll ring the police. And he just up and gone and come back, got the car and that like. And unfortunately, because I only had two children to him, one of them decided that they'd go to live with him. And they live local. I hadn't seen my youngest son for about 3 years till the other day I saw him on the street and said, hello, how are you? But he's never been to visit me. Mm. He tells his sister strange things because I think he's listened to his father's version.
Mm. That must be
so hard. That's isolated.
Wow. So he has no contact with you or the other members of his family?
Only one. He talks to one of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Mm-hmm. I had hoped when I had my children, because I had five all up, was to try to break that chain. I wanted to keep them all close. And I used to read them the Riot Act when they were fighting, you know, stop your brothers or brother and sister or whatever. And when it all boils, that's all you got, each other. But all this other stuff got in the way and now they're all split up too. One lives in Brisbane and that one doesn't talk to the other one that lives here. And
Families are quite complicated sometimes, yeah, aren't they, in the dynamics so within families.
Sort of failed there. My daughter lives with me. I rent a house. I don't have any real friends. I have people to talk to, but I don't let them in either. And I don't do anything else much. I just hang out at home.
And it's interesting, when we were having this conversation last week, you talked about needing to get out sometimes. Even though you were isolated, you created connection through getting back in nature, going through for walks in nature, reconnecting with nature. And I had this, I don't know, for me it was just this sense of, yes, I've gone through this very privileged, you know, had my family's support and felt very connected through work and family and through my journey. But other people like me experience the same sense of loneliness and isolation, and we don't know how to always put good strategies in place to deal with that. Intuitively, you knew what to do. You went out, you went, right, this is what's working for me, reconnecting with nature. Talk me through that.
No, it was always something, even when I was a child. I used to camp out in the yard of my grandparents' house. But it's like when you're out there, everything out there is real. And this is going to sound funny, but it's real and it's innocently real. It's just doing its own thing. It's nature. It's just growing. And you watch the animals going about their own little day. And they, you know, and it's just a whole different other sort of little world. But if you try to do that here in town, it's just noises. There's artificial noises.
Mm.
You hear the insects. There's actually a lot of noise. People always say it's so quiet out there, but it's not quiet.
Mm.
If you listen, it's actually fairly loud. And that's just like yesterday, went for a drive out bush. But since I've had these leg injuries and that, I can't get out and walk.
Okay.
Very far. So that's, I can drive out there, but I can't get out and walk and for miles. So that's a bit of a bummer. Mm.
But there's a way you can still reconnect.
I can still go out there. But, you know, but it just, I used to walk for miles.
Yeah. That form of deep listening, I think, and you referred to deep listening, and I'd like you to sort of tell us a little bit more about that. But for some people, they pay to go to meditation classes, or they have apps on their phone around meditation. This is a form of deep connection and meditation, isn't it, when we talk about deep listening? Tell us about that.
Well, I see it's the same thing. I went to a couple of meditation classes once, and that's all they were doing, clearing their mind and listening for anything would come through sort of thing. And that's all you do. You go bush, find a place you'd want to sit under the tree and just sit there and clear your mind. And sometimes, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but sometimes you can feel energy come through the ground on your feet. And again, it's about me. It's about being real. It's not artificial. It's
I love that.
It's real, you know. And there are places that are still relatively untouched. you know, you can go to. And, yeah, sometimes you find little treasures there. I'm a terrible one for bringing home stone sticks and things that just say, hey, take me.
Mm.
And so they always remind me of my little trips out. But was it real? It's natural. It's and you get to say, well, I didn't, you know, your mind's just clear, and or you can hone in on the actual, the noises, the sounds, you know, crickets and insects and
that,
what have you.
And I know from my own experience, I love taking the shoes off, putting my feet on the ground, and I actually love nothing more than just being by myself in those sorts of environments and the connection that you feel. Yeah. It's quite, it feels a little bit yin and yang in saying, you know, or contradictory, that you're by yourself out in the middle of nowhere and you're actually going, I'm feeling connected. Yeah. It's, yeah, it's hard to sort of wrap your head around until you actually do that, right?
I guess we're all part of the earth, aren't we?
Yeah.
You know, one world. And, you know, all the ancient cultures, they all did that sort of thing and connected in one way or another to the earth and just, yeah.
So simple. We can overcomplicate things sometimes, Sharon, I think, can't we?
Oh, easy.
Yeah, something so simple, but, you know, as a way of reconnecting, just to go out in nature, go for a walk.
And I take my writing pad with me. I've written, I sometimes used to sit there and you just write. It can be like random thoughts because they do pop into your head. I don't know where they come from, but sitting in the middle of nowhere and, you know, a few words might flicker through. So I write them down and I don't sit there and concentrate on trying to write anything. And then you go home and you read back through them and you find then you can build onto them. It's almost like these things come to you from there.
Because you've got the space, sometimes, isn't it? You've created just that spaciousness within your mind just to allow things to come without judgment.
My mind can be very actually noisy sometimes.
I think we can all relate to that. Yeah,
too many voices, too many noises in there. And, so silence is really good.
I love that. Sharon, I was doing a little bit of research prior to our episode today and looking at, I've talked a lot about from the Western perspective, Maslow's hierarchy, you know, and we talk about meeting, you know, getting our basic needs met, and it turns into this pyramid where it's about self-actualization. Mm. And the comparison, because Blackfoot wisdom was in place before, you know, Maslow's hierarchy, Abraham Maslow learnt from Blackfoot wisdom, and it's actually flipped on its head when we talk, it's inverse. Yeah. So self-actualization is actually at the bottom. It's this belief that people come with everything that they need and the wisdom, self-wisdom that they need to create the pathways that they want to create. And then that next level is around the community then supporting you. Mm. It's not about the person having all the answers. It's about how we connect back into the community. Have you got any thoughts around Blackfoot wisdom and how you might have, you know, reflected on that during your own life?
Maybe if I'd have stayed in a, like with my grandparents, so that I came up to what I saw as that, or then I would have seen the different pathways in community or who I could have reached out for help or took part of or something, but not in the way I did, and not really.
Because you had that real community up to the age of 9, didn't you?
Yeah.
You had wrapped around.
I've had that too. When I've other times I've left and I've gone to the communities, you know. So I lived in Redfern for a few years. So there's that same community there, but there's different lifestyle altogether. Same at Walgett, so that I have been part of those communities. For some strange reason, that is different. But if I'm on an Aboriginal community or with Aboriginal friends, there's a difference, different feeling, I don't feel like I'm getting judged. I don't feel like I always belong, but I don't feel like there's a judgment call either.
And I guess it really highlights that we've all got our own unique path that we go down. However, there's always options there. I know that for you there was isolation, but you found an option to relieve some of that by going out into the bush or reconnecting with people who you felt like you couldn't connect with. But there is this common thread for you that the relationships were hard to form because you didn't have those bonds and there was that lack of trust, but also that willingness and that decision to isolate yourself from relationships due to fear or as a protection mechanism because you felt like eventually you were going to be let down. For some of us, that's not as real yet. We still have these feelings of isolation that we live with every day.
I can imagine that, because, everybody's got – what is it? You should be nice to everybody you meet because you don't know what demons they're fighting, you know?
Yeah.
So true. And sometimes even there was other times there when I was a bit lonely or whatever, and I used to go, I'd sit over here or other towns, just sit in the seats on the main street or – something like that. And then eventually somebody comes and sits down. You say, g'day, how you going? How's the weather? And you sit there and have a little chat. And sometimes that's all you need, just to libraries are good for that. But hello, good morning, how you going? It's simple as that, but it makes your day a bit more pleasant, you know. Everyone's not just the people who walk their dogs up the street in the morning because I get up early and you give them a wave and, you know, they're there. But again, you'd never – I would have no idea how to form a relationship with any of these people, you know. Like, oh, do you want to come to my house to have coffee? You know, that's weird.
And yet for other people, that's pretty standard. Yeah. You know, that's what they – that's their MO.
I believe it's going to get worse because – of all these scams that are going on, people are being told every day not to trust a little bit. And this thing with the mobile phones where the kids today, not always just kids, but young adults, they can't say hello to your face. They stand there with their heads down and they shuffle their feet.
Because as parents, we tell the kids don't talk to strangers, right? It's funny, I'm just reflecting on you talking about society and the changes and those levels of trust around scams. There was some sort of video I was watching where this guy's gone into a lift because he said, you know, people don't talk to each other in lifts. Could only be two people in there and they just don't want to make eye contact or they're on their phones. So he took in it was part of a social project. He took in a box of chocolates into the lift. He's eating them, but he's offering them to people. And it's like,
nope.
Oh, no, I'm good, thanks. And they'd sort of turn away from him like he had three heads.
Yeah.
But just something so simple where he was doing a gesture of kindness to go, oh, I'm eating these chocolates. Would you like one? Oh, no, thank you. And then just to watch them turn away. It was actually on the SBS, I think. It was a social project. Just to see the behaviours. You've absolutely nailed it, you know, that we are becoming more programmed to have this heightened response and fearful response with other people who we don't know.
I don't know where it'll ever end up. But, I mean, years ago everybody knew their neighbours, at least knew their name. They'd hang over the fence and same thing, have a yarn or whatever. That's who you should be able to rely on for a certain, you know, certain extent, like a disaster or something. It might sound weird, but my daughter likes to go to old graveyards and read the – it's not morbid, she just likes to read the
– the history.
There's some funny, yeah. And some of the older cemeteries that we've been to, and I look at the graves, they're all breaking down and and I was thinking to myself, where's the family? There must be somebody left. Do they even know where this grave is? Because it's just left to crumble like the people didn't exist.
So Sharon, we will finish up. Thank you so much for your time. Have you got any pearls of wisdom, I guess, around building connection, building that sense of community within our communities? What would you like to see from people in the future?
Well, I'd just like to see people be like a little bit more friendlier. Like I said, say g'day to the person in the street. You know, if you see that somebody is struggling, you know, try and help them. You know, something as simple as if you just see people walking, struggling with a car, putting their groceries in the car. Sometimes when you do just a simple little thing like that, it makes you feel good too. So that's a win-win situation. Just take some time, you know, slow down and listen and look and just and look after yourself in the meantime. That's about it.
And so hearing those suggestions from you, I guess, and knowing now, you know, the background that you've shared with us, that can't be always easy for you to step outside of that and be willing to speak to people, knowing that you've got already got this protective armour wrapped around you in protecting yourself.
Yeah, but then sometimes I look at these people and I think, you know, they just look so sad or something, and so you say hello, you know.
Yeah,
you
beautiful.
You know, I've been told off, I've been called names, you know. But other people don't seem to have a chat. And, I just think the elderly ones are getting more and more isolated. But you need other people. You're a herd. A human being is a herd animal. They were never meant to live alone. They shouldn't have to. But, you know, if they want, everyone can get on. They just everyone's got to learn to bend a little bit. So,
yeah, great advice. So a big thank you to Sharon for joining us. What a powerful story. If you or anyone that you know is feeling isolated or would need support, we will put these resources at the end of the podcast. So please feel free to tap in and check these out. Friendline supports anyone who's feeling lonely or needs to reconnect or just wants to have a chat. You can call them 7 days a week on 1-800-424-287, or you can chat online with one of their trained volunteers. eFriend is a free service that allows people to access up to 15 virtual peer support sessions per video or phone call. Their peer workers can offer insight, provide hope, and empathize from their own lived experience, whether you're looking for support or just someone to have a chat to. Beyond Blue Support Service offers a free, confidential, and counseling service for all Australians looking for a little help with their mental health. You can call them on 1300 224 636 or access their web chat or email support 24/7. Thank you for listening to this episode of Stronger Together. Sometimes the issues we discuss in Stronger Together may be triggering for some people. If you have been affected by the topics we have discussed today, please reach out for help. You can call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 13 11 14, or you can use the chat option on their website.
If you live in the Wide Bay Burnett region, you can also reach out to us at Impact Community Services. Go to impact.org.au and click on the Make a Referral button at the top if you wish to self-refer. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode, and if so, please remember to hit the subscribe button. Until next time, remember, we're stronger together.